Papers are due, as we know, April 26th. I realized this morning, I noticed it. I screwed up your exams and I didn't open them up the grades for you to see, but I corrected that. I did that. That's done. I'm not going to let you look at the exams until there's two people that did not take the exams. Although, great, they don't usually show up, but I can't open the exams up and let you see the exams until I find out if they're basically going to get Fs. They've just given up. Or they got some type of medical issue or whatever. So as soon as I hear from them, I'll let you know, and then you'll be able to see what you did. But overall, it was a tough exam. We covered a lot. And the grades were about what I expected them to be. So, but no big deal. We are three in. Those are all worth 15%. So you take the three grades, add them together, divide by three, and that's your current average. The next grade is the paper. That's worth 20%. Obviously more than the exam. So if you follow directions and you submit a decent paper, then that will offset any low grades on either of the first three exams. 45% plus 20 is 65%. That will only leave the final exam, which is not cumulative. All the final exam is the fourth exam. But we're supposed to make the final exams worth more, so that's what I did. So if you bombed one exam, but you give me a good paper, and you crush it on the final, you should be fine. And with the exception of the people that don't really come anymore, no, I'm not worried about anyone failing that attends regularly. Except for this guy. We'll just give him the F just because. Fair?
Sounds pretty fair.
Nice. That's what I like it. All right. So, we were talking about the collapse of the czarist regime, the attempt by the provisional government to take control and possibly create a republic. We also talked about the reality of things. They made a huge mistake. If you give freedom to people who've never had freedom before, it could descend into chaos, particularly if you keep the nation involved in a war that no one wants to be in anymore. So ultimately, that was what would cause the complete collapse. Of course, the icing on the cake was the Kornilov affair, hugely embarrassing. And at that point, there really was no government. Fast forward to October or November on our calendar, and the Bolshevists had infiltrated the Soviets, and then on October 24th on their calendar, they launched what is known as the October Revolution. Now, according to Trotsky's propaganda, it was a violent seizure of power against superior forces. But the truth be told, it was a bloodless coup. If there were any military forces, they had joined with them. The only group that held out was a small unit of the Women's Battalion. They remained in the fight. And they started shooting at the Bolshevists when they tried going to the government offices. But they didn't have many bullets. And when they ran out of bullets, they surrendered. Don't know what the Bolshevists did to them, but I can imagine. Bunch of ladies, probably wasn't too pleasant. But nonetheless, that was the only resistance, so did they seize power? Yeah, they seized power in a bloody struggle, as much as it takes me to sit down in a chair, because that's actually what they did. They went into the government offices, and there was no one there, and they just sat down at the desks, and they took over. But Russia was still in the war, regardless of what was going on in the capital. So, after declaring the creation of what would become known as a Soviet democracy, the remnants of the government officials that could be found in St. Petersburg were arrested. The Bolshevists also took possession of Nicholas and his family, who, FYI, well, actually, I should ask you, did anyone know what happened to the Tsar and his wife and his girls and his son?
They're all lined up and shot.
Where?
Wasn't it, like, outside St. They dumped them in, like, the river?
No.
So it was close. It was in a farmhouse in like central. I want to say it was in like Central Asia, or not Central Asia. What's that fucking territory called? It's like Kazakhstan or something like that. It's one
of the stands.
It was in a house in there. They had guards guarding them, and then they got drunk, put them all in the basement, and shot them.
Yeah, but even more gruesome, they told them that it was only going to be there temporarily, that they were transporting them to a safer place. Apparently, there are some people who suggest that Lenin assured them that they were going to send them to Vladivostok out in Siberia, allow them to get on a ship and sail to the United States. So they went along with no resistance. So according to the testimony of one of the guards who was present, yes, they did get all liquored up one night, but they received the order from the boss to eliminate them. So they told the Tsar, the Tsarina, and all of the girls and the son, we're just going to go down in the basement, we're going to pull a truck up to a garage door, and we're going to do that so that way you're safe, so no one will see you. Well, unfortunately, when they went down into the basement, there was no garage door. They were just in a room. So what do the guards do? They walk in. One of them pretends he's a photographer. But the other guys pull out their guns and just start going bam, 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 bam.
So Tsarina means queen, right?
Yes. Because that's what we do in democracies. But as far as the war goes, well, one of the first things that he did was move to get Russia out of the war. That, after all, was part of his propaganda. On October 25th, Russian calendar, November 8th, our calendar, Lenin would sign what became known as Decree on Peace, which, and I quote, called upon all belligerent nations and their governments to start immediate negotiations for peace. Needless to say, nobody in London or Paris or Berlin gave £2 of sand what this guy said. But it was an acknowledgement that the Soviet Union was done. Trotsky, who Lenin appointed as foreign commissar, was allowed to contact the German government in the end of November, and negotiations began, which would culminate on December 15th with an armistice. What's an armistice?
A ceasefire, almost?
Correct. It's not a surrender. It's a ceasefire. And I had a hard time finding pictures, but I love this shot because we have a German with a Russian, with a Russian, with a German, with a German, with a Russian, with a German, with a Russian, with a German, with a Russian. Taken on the day, both sides stopped shooting at one another. Then the following week, meeting in German occupied Belarus in the city of Brest-Litovsk, now just called Brest, Russian and German dignitaries would basically hammer out a treaty. Now, it would take them until March before the treaty would be formalized. In it, Russia would default on all agreements it made with the Entente. So any promises that the Tsar's government made to the English or the French or anybody else, no more. It's void. 11 of the nations that made up the Russian Empire were given their independence, including Eastern Europe and in Asia. Germany, however, would be given a hegemony, the ability to control the Eastern European countries, Poland, the Baltic states, Ukraine, and Finland. All, well, Finland's cut off, but all of from there down to there. Now, here's the amazing thing. In signing this away, Lenin gave to the Germans 30% of its pre-war population, 90% of its coal, and 80% of its iron. And, as it was discovered later, also huge oil reserves, which they were never able to tap. But that's the reason why the Battle of Stalingrad occurred in World War II. Now, by the way, oh, I should have looked. I didn't even see this note that I made when I wrote this class like 4 years ago. This was the first peace process that was actually recorded on video. So I'm a nerd. I'll have to look that up on YouTube. See if anyone posted that footage. Questions? Now here's the kicker. This piece hugely benefited the Germans. Because now all of the men, all of the materiel that they're using to fight the Russians, they can now put on trains and shipped to the West. And of course, for me, one of the greatest ironies about that was the exact opposite of the German pre-war plans. Remember, they were going to knock the West out first and then knock the East out. Well, the East gets knocked. Granted, it took 3 years, but the East is done, and now we'll focus on the West. By the way, this is the reason why the Allies hated Lenin. Because the Allies believed that the Russians essentially stabbed them in the back. One of the little known tidbits of history is that during the events that would unfold in 1919, a combined American, French, British, and German force would actually invade Russian territory. Because of what was going on in Russia was completely out of control. Sure. They left the war, but there would be no peace because a violent event known as the Russian Civil War erupted. And it literally was a brutal fight to the death between the communists, the Reds, and the remnants of the Tsar's regime and the provisional government, who are known as the White Russians. As violent as the First World War is, this is honestly as bad, if not worse, proportionally speaking. You had 5 million people die, plus, in the middle of it, typhus broke out, and another 3 million people died. Plus, a famine erupted, killing another 16 million people. On top of the upwards of 15 million people that had died in Russia, you're talking roughly 40% of Russia's pre-war population dead in a decade.
If you put all the numbers together, that's around like 30 to 40 million people who died in that Russian Civil War.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
It's really ridiculous.
How many people live in Russia? Holy shit.
Not as many as lived that were alive in 1922, 23 as it was in 1914, that's for sure.
Evidently so.
But in the end, the Reds won. Lenin barely managed to survive, but in a claiming victory, he would hammer together what would become known as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Commonly referred to as the USSR. But, and this is a topic for another class, upon achieving victory in the Civil War, Lenin vowed to get his revenge on the capitalist world. He intended on making the USSR the global center of a revolution against capitalism. That would result in the destruction of all civilization that pre-existed the Soviet Union. and it would emerge as Russia ruling the world. Questions? Imagine what Lenin would have said if he was alive when Gorbachev came in and implemented glasnost. Yeah.
So wasn't there a continuation more after World War I for the Soviet Union to get all their free territory back? Because I know they went to war with Poland and Ukraine.
They wouldn't get all that until World War II.
I thought that was like during like the 20s, like the USSR was trying to get that territory back.
They could barely hold it together. Barely hold it together. Well, what ended up happening is some of the territory that went to Germany under Brest-Litovsk, as we're going to see during the Peace of Paris, all of that was stripped. So what ended up happening is some of the former territories actually went back in and joined with.
I see.
Like the Ukrainians. Stupid. All right. But like I said, that's a topic for another class. Other questions? All righty. So, we're done with 1916. Why don't we get on to what was going on the battlefields of the Western Front in 1917. Well, I think this kind of says it all. 1917 was not a good year for the Allies whatsoever. Let's click. Ah, there's a lag. All right, go back. All right. On the French side, the French government lost its patience with Joseph Joffre, so he was sacked, and he would be replaced by General Robert Nivelle, who, if you recall, was ultimately the commander that brought about a victory in Verdun, because Pétain was promoted. Now, Nivelle boasted to the French government that he, based on what he learned at Verdun, would be able to break through the German lines, would be able to bring fluidity back to the battlefield, and ultimately achieve victory. Heck, Nivelle was so convincing, Prime Minister David Lloyd George granted to Nivelle full command control over the British forces, to which Haig was furious about. But Haig and Lloyd George didn't get along. Haig protested formally, and I quote, saying, "It would be madness to place British forces under the French." But Haig, who had a big ego, was unwilling to put that threat to the point where he threatened to resign if it occurred. So he basically said, "Don't do it," but he didn't take the final step. Now to Nivelle, he came to believe that the artillery tactics, which were mastered at Verdun, would ultimately be the key to achieving victory elsewhere on the Western Front. If you recall, we have the creeping barrage. So, you first send a wave of artillery, you blow up the barbed wire, and then you advance the angle of your artillery to continue to pound the enemy in front of your charging forces. He believed this would unlock trench warfare. And he put it to the test. On April 16th, 1917, France would launch its first assault of 1917, which would become known as the Nivelle Offensive. This would be a combined attack in which both the Brits and the French would attack simultaneously at different points. The front technically stretched from Soissons to Rennes. But there would be specific points of attack. points at which Nival believed the Germans were at their weakest. Doing what the Germans did at Verdun, they spent the entire end of winter, early spring, building up their forces. They amassed 850,000 men. Whereas along this stretch, there was only about 400,000 to 500,000 Germans. The main strike would be delivered by the French on Chaume de la Maine, down here, in what would become known as the Second Battle of Anzy. But the Brits would launch a secondary strike to the north, near Arras. The idea was hit them from the right, and then the next day hit them from the left. And they wouldn't be able to stretch their forces, and they would cause a snap. The goal, the plan, we're going to break through the German defenses in 48 hours. That's all it's going to take. We're going to be so quick, so lethal, we will get into Belgium. And then, once they're through, the French and the British forces would join together, liberate all of Belgium, and then hit the German border. That was the plan. Five thousand Allied guns were brought in. And for 14 days, they fired nonstop. Approximately 3 million shells were fired. But, the Germans learned lessons too. And the Germans realized the best way to negate a set-piece battle was through defense in depth. Going back to October 1916, Hindenburg, as we covered briefly, had ordered the construction of a line of defensive positions known as the, well, the Germans called it the Siegfried Line, but the Entente would come to call it the Hindenburg Line. Long story short, the artillery, sure, it may hit the barbed wire, it may hit the front trench, but unbeknownst to the Allies, the front trench is only lightly manned. The rear strength is in the secondary trench, and not too far back of the reserves. So as the guns come down and pound the barbed wire and start pounding the first trench, they have to stop firing to let their men run across. And as the British and the French troops penetrate the front trench, guess what's coming up from the backside? Germans. By the way, much to the shock of the Brits and the French when they got into the French trench, they realized most of the German positions are actually concrete structures. Because guess what the Germans had been doing? Prefabrication. They were building these structures way behind the lines, and they were putting them on trains and transporting them up into the front. And they actually would use not only highly skilled German laborers, but they also would bring in Russian POWs. And all through the winter, while everyone hunkered down, they're digging and they're building. FYI, from October to March, 1,300 train loads of materials reached the same stretch that Naval planned on attacking. He wasn't just going through a field, he was going into fortified positions. Dum da dum 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 dum. Oh, I also should talk about this. Notice how they're created. Interlocking points of fire and defense. You don't put your gun back here, you put your guns on the corners, and you basically can sweep the area. And every point is interconnected. Look, there's an underground latrine, there are some bunkers for the frontline guys when the artillery starts hitting, there's an ammunition depot, another bathroom, and then you have the connecting trenches. And look, here's the secondary lines. Every area has a dugout where the guys can go underground and be safe. And of course, you have the lines that go all the way to the rear. 200 yards apart, 400 yards apart. So yeah, you race across no man's land and you think you're there, but it's only a matter of time before out come the Germans. Oh, one last little factoid in here. 100 yards of barbed wire just to get to there. This, when the Allies got in, is what would trigger a French revolt. Why? They were told they were going to break through. And wave after wave of young French man and young British soldier gets into the German trenches, only to, before you know it, the Jerry is coming out of nowhere and fighting back. Naval promised 8 miles on the first day. They only got a few hundred yards. And when the German counterstrike happened, it was ridiculous. The worst part is, the French soldiers realized that their commanding officer was an idiot. Why? Because he kept saying, we're going to send wave after wave after wave after wave. And the French soldiers had had it. So, beginning around early May, about a couple of weeks after this battle started, entire units began to mutiny. Now, they didn't leave. They simply said, we're not going to fight. Why? This was stupid. They were going to die. They were going to run to their deaths, and they didn't want to die for this cause anymore. To make matters worse, we're now talking March, April, May, and word from socialist newspapers reported, and the soldiers could read, on the February Revolution, when the Tsar's government was toppled. The French soldiers actually became convinced Germany was going to win. So why do I want to die in a losing war? I want to go home. I want to see my wife. I want to see my kids. See my mother. 49 divisions. We're talking hundreds of thousands of men. Said, we're not going to fight. For that guy, Naval, in a losing war. Now, I should mention again, when the officers went in and started ordering them to move, the men didn't attack the officers. They just refused to attack. Now, there were some mutineers as well. And ironically, many of the mutineers were actually veterans who had been fighting for year two or three. When they left the front, they didn't have necessarily intentions on running home. Many of them tried going to points where there were politicians or going to where there were newspapers. They, more than anything, wanted to make the authorities and the people of France aware of what this trench warfare was all about, because the government imposed censorship. FYI, about 27,000 soldiers did desert. Many of them would later be arrested, and some, just a few hundred, would be hung as traitors. But when word got out, the French government realized they had a political mess on their hands, and they decided to point the blame on the person who was sending the soldiers to their death, Nivelle. He was sacked, and he was replaced by the general who actually cared for his men, Henri Petain. With Petain at the helm, remember the guy who implemented the rotation of troops? The guy who actually went to the front lines, talked to the soldiers, saw what the conditions were all about? The French believed they would achieve a victory. Oh, and by the time the change occurred, the French were also willing to deploy a new tool of death. The Saint-Chamond tanks. The French would build a heavy trench. Sorry, a heavy tank. Trench. Why did I say trench? Well, because tanks are on my mind. And what was the whole purpose of the design of the Mark tanks?
To go over trenches.
To go over trenches. That was not the purpose of the French tanks. The French tanks, as you can see, were meant to be armored artillery pieces. So, in order to have creeping barrages, you must be able to bring the guns forward. But the problem with bringing your guns forward is you potentially could get in the range of your enemy's guns. So basically, the French designed these. You can see them. These are 75 millimeter guns, the same guns that made the that was the weapon that was the advantage that the French had throughout the whole war. They had the best artillery pieces and out of all the armies. So you put it in a steel chassis, you drive it forward, and you're able to get the bombardment closer. It was heavy, 23 tons, and it had thicker armor than the German Mark tanks. And it was faster, almost twice as fast as the British Mark tanks. But the problem is its design, and that's the reason why I put this picture in here. If you notice, the tracks are not exactly in the dead center of the tank. Because on the front of the tank is the gun carriage. It creates this huge nose that comes out. So if you're going over perfectly flat ground, that's perfect, as long as it's hard packed. But if it has any wave to it, what ends up happening is you end up getting the gun in the front jammed into the mud. Which means if you're trying to go and your nose gets stuck in the mud, it's going to create a drag, which potentially could cause you to basically become bogged down.
It also wrecks the gun, too.
Completely. If it goes that far. So what they ended up doing when they drove, they either put the gun in or they raised it high above so that way it would not be impacted. But you had the compartment and all the muck and the goo could get inside.
Yeah, and if you get all that mud and shit in the gun, you have to clean the whole gun out, because if you don't, then that, if you fire around, it's going to explode inside the gun and kill everybody.
Oh, and by the way, that happened many times.
Oh, I don't doubt that one bit. So it happens with rifles, by the way. If you have a rifle and you put dirty ammunition in there, it can explode inside your gun and kill you.
Yep. All right, so the first tanks were deployed at a minor battle that was part of the end of the Nivelle Offensive, a battle at La Fox-Mille. In total, sixteen were sent into battle, but 12 of them got stuck trying to cross the trenches. And at the end of the battle, only 5 were still fully functioning. But the good news was, several of their tanks, even the ones that got stuck in the mud, had gotten hit directly with German artillery rounds. And amazingly, of the ones that were stuck, the 12, only 3 of them were destroyed. So the French, kind of this ugly beast, were kind of on to something. Questions? By the way, the flaws would cause the French to reconsider tank warfare. And so in 1918, instead of having heavy tanks, they would begin using light tanks, which we'll talk about next week or the following week. All right. Well, Pétain's in charge. When Naval was sacked, Lloyd George refused to give Pétain operational control over the British. So that forced Pétain to have to beg for help. And ironically, Haig liked Pétain. He hated Naval, but he liked Pétain. So it didn't take much convincing. Because Haig was ready to engage in a full-blown, large-scale operation of his own. Because he believed he could punch through the lines in Flanders Fields. If he could get through here, he could actually cause the entire 400-long trench to curl. And why there? Well, Flanders is flat, which would allow a cavalry charge, because Haig was an old cavalry guy. And if they turned it here, you could start using Ostend and a few of the other Belgian ports to bring more men, more supplies, to be able to penetrate behind the lines. Because after all, England has control of the channel, other than the Unterseeboats. Plus, right up in here, in Flushing, the Germans had a U-boat base there. So if they could get here, they could use the army and take out the U-boats. And the best part is, it was completely removed from the French forces. And Haig, truth be told, hated the French. He found them obnoxious. So he had this great idea. He was all excited about it. But you know something? He didn't come up with any new type of strategy. No innovations, no new ideas. His intent was to do a set piece strike, but bigger. That was his plan. I'm going to use more guns, and I'm going to use more men, and I'm going to send more people across no man's land, and eventually we're going to just overwhelm them. We're going to use a steamroller. Here's your analogy. I'm going to get out of the room. Right? I'm going to get out of the room. I'm just going to keep pushing harder and harder and harder. And eventually I'm going to open the door. Even though it opens this way. Not that way.
Now, ironically, at this point, we're now in March, April, May 1917. British politicians are terrified that a socialist revolt could take place in London. And they're terrified of what would happen if the Russians dropped out. I mean, after all, none of them had any idea what was going on in Russia. And when the Russian volcano exploded, it came as a complete shock to the world. But that literally caused many of the politicians and Labour and the Conservative parties to sit back and think, oh my God, our people are getting pissed off at how long this war is going on. Our people are sick and tired of seeing the coffins coming home. Well, actually, most of the bodies are buried in Europe, but the few that did come back, or reading the dead list that's printed in the newspaper day after day after day, or God forbid, when an officer shows up at a mother's house knocking on the door saying, "I'm sorry, ma'am, your son's not coming home." People were tired. And to make matters worse, for 3 years of war, what did the British have to show for all this? Nothing. Nothing. Yeah. Recognizing this, the newly appointed Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, wanted to sack Haig to make him the scapegoat to save the politicians. You know, it's not our fault. We gave him all the tools he needed. It's his fault. But Haig was sack-proof because he was close friends with none other than King George V. And the king, under the British parliamentary system, was responsible for not necessarily hiring and firing the prime minister, but if a prime minister gets a vote of no confidence from the king or the queen, he's gone. So, in effect, there was nothing that the head of the government could do to stop the general who was killing hundreds of thousands of British soldiers, other than sit back and hold on for the ride. Questions? In comes the third Battle of Ypres. The first battle started when the Germans tried in the race to the sea, hooking around the British lines, and the British held them at bay. The second Battle of Ypres was started so the Germans could show, look, we're still fighting. But this was triggered by the Brits, by Haig. He believed that if he had enough men and enough artillery focused on a narrow point in the line, he could break through. And then once he broke through, there was nothing but open land behind him. And of course, this would be another set piece battle. So what do? You begin by unleashing your artillery to blow up as much of the barbed wire as possible. FYI, in a 17-day bombardment, British guns would fire over 3.7 million rounds. Plus, prior to the bombardment, their sappers had been digging. And along the front, the British put in 21 mines, filling those mines with over 1 million pounds of TNT. Now here's the funny thing. The Germans knew the Brits were mining because they had counter-listening positions, because they learned from 1916. So towards their front lines, they actually had underground positions. Under where the barbed wire was, they had listening posts. Because you can't hide them. Digging. So, for the most part, as they heard the digging get closer, they began pulling more and more troops off the front trench, moving them either to the second or putting them in the reserves. Because they knew what was coming. May 22nd is when the guns started. On June 7th, 3:15 a.m., the mines were blown. The earth heaved, and the front German positions virtually disappeared. And these poor guys got caught up in it, and they got quite blown it up. By the way, this crater was one of their biggest mines. It was so big, and as we mentioned in Flanders, the water table's high. By the end of the battle, because of how the high of the water table was, it naturally filled in with water. He also had 375,000 men, and he brought in 72 of the new Mark IV tanks. The biggest difference with the Mark IV was, bless you, the gas tanks are now in the back, and notice this overarching structure. There is a gearbox here that when turned on, it allowed this to basically be a belt. I should have had a picture of it, but I didn't. One of the things that British military intelligence realized was that because of the weight of the tanks, based on what they learned tonight at the Battle of the Somme, is that when the tanks get to the trenches, if the trenches aren't strong enough, they basically just sink in. So what they did was they put huge bundles of sticks that could be manually brought from the rear and dropped off in the front when they got up to the trenches, allowing them to drive right over. I thought I put a picture of that, but I guess I didn't. All right. Now, interestingly enough, when the battle began and the 9 divisions of British forces surged forward, because of the fact that the Germans had pulled back, they actually were able to take the high ground. One of the few elevated positions on all of Flanders. I mean, this is nothing more than a hill, no higher than any hills in Worcester, but look, as far as the eye can see in the back, it's just all flat. But at a huge cost. Because after everything went boom, 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 the Germans moved forward and started going ka 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 ka. They took the high ground, cost them 25,000 men. To the Germans, 2,000. Why didn't the Germans surge back? Well, the Germans had a plan. The Germans had a plan. They were going to use a new chemical to basically terrify and incapacitate and hopefully kill as many of the Brits as possible. What the Germans called Gelbkreis. Yellow cross, which of course we call mustard gas. What do you know about mustard gas?
It kills you fast.
No, actually it doesn't.
It kills you very, very, very slowly. You ever heard of it?
It's how you breathe, right? So.
Yeah, like your lungs, essentially, you're breathing in blood. Terrible. But I don't know if you ever heard of the attack of the dead men, but when the Germans launched mustard gas at the Russians, instead of them just laying there dying, they hopped out of their forts and charged them with bayonets while the Germans were coming up to take the fort that they were defending. Germans were crazy. The Russians were crazy.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, they had nothing to live for, so they might as well fight to the death.
They tied bandanas to their faces. There was a report saying that the Germans thought they were, like, dead, like zombies.
Yeah.
Yep. They were running out them with bayonets, coughing up friggin' chunks of their lungs. They're bleeding out of their mouths.
Nasty stuff. Mm-hmm. All right, well, here we go. Now, mustard gas was not a new chemical. It was actually invented by French scientists in the 1820s. But it would basically be increased, and I don't want to say weaponized, but I guess kind of weaponized, by the British in the 1860s. There was actually talk that the Confederacy would buy mustard gas and attempt to use it in the Civil War. But of course, there was a situation where Lincoln went in and seized a British ship that they were going to sell to the Confederacy, and England decided, no, we'll stay neutral. But imagine that as a what if. Because what mustard gas is, it's not a gas, but rather it's a blistering agent that when released is not gaseous, but it comes out in like a spray. So what ends up happening is wherever it's let go, the entire surface area of everything within the radius becomes contaminated. And the contaminants remain active for weeks, particularly if it's warm and it's moist, like Flanders Fields. So what it ends up happening is there's a burst, and it smells like a combination of garlic and mustard, and that's the reason why it's called mustard gas, yes?
It's nothing comparable to like the residue that was left behind after the Japanese bombings, right?
Well, what the Japanese were unleashing was the plague, so yeah, nothing quite as bad as that. All right, but anyway, so you got the droplets. So this means a bomb goes, and 5 days later you come up and you put your hand on the table. And you don't realize you now just got mustard gas contaminants all over your fingers. And imagine what happens when you eat food.
That's a lot of internal bleeding.
Yeah. Clothing, equipment, seats, bathrooms. Once the area is contaminated, it could take a week to 2 weeks to 3 weeks for its natural shelf life to expire. So what ends up happening? Well, you get it in on you. And to make matters worse, if you were, say, hiding inside in a bunker when it went and you thought you were safe, no. If any of your buddies were outside and they came in on their clothes, on their uniform, and they went to take it off, it would just be circulated throughout the air. And then it would become an aerosol, which means you can inhale it. And toxicity. Huge. Huge, huge. You ingest it, and you could get very sick. If you ingest enough, you could die. But the most common results of mustard gas was this. Wherever your skin was exposed, it would blister and be a painful burning rash. Or if you got it in the face, you could go blind. Usually temporarily, but in some instances permanently. And of course, imagine what happens to your inside. Blistering agent, all your larynx and your lungs all start blistering. Yeah, you could die in a very painful way.
Yeah, you'll start looking like
very
King Baldwin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, except he had leprosy.
Yeah. You'd probably look like you had leprosy after getting that all over you, though.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure, because I can't imagine that your skin is going to be able to heal itself, but FYI, from the time it was first introduced until the last rounds were fought by both sides, by the way, the British and the French, once the Germans used it, said, well, it's that effective, we'll use it too. Somewhere between 2-3% of all soldiers fighting experience some type of consequences from being exposed to mustard gas. All right. But the Germans only had so many rounds, and once they ran out of rounds, it would allow the Brits to once again re-engage in the attack. While they were able to take the high ground, Haig, once that was secure, ordered them to penetrate in another salient that had developed, a bulge, in and around Ypres. And this was a massive offensive. In one charge, 29 divisions of soldiers, 3,000 guns were unleashed, 136 tanks. Everything went in motion. He believed, we're going to do it this time. Why? Well, he was believing the streams of intelligence that was coming into his headquarters, in which it was reported in several instances, and I quote, the German is marked and unmistakable, suffering in a fall of morale. They believed that the Germans were beaten. But, you know, it was never verified. And what happens if you just listen to the first thing that someone tells you without checking to see if it's true? Haig didn't realize that was the whole purpose of the Siegfried line. You give up the front trench, maybe you give up the second trench, but all your strength's in the rear. And it's just a matter of the guys coming out of their concrete bunkers and attacking again. The counter-strike was more on a scale of success than the initial strike itself. The Germans were not suffering for morale. No. They were just waiting for the green light to charge. And when they did, it was only a matter of time before they drove the British back. Plus, the terrain favored the Germans. Yeah, it was flat, other than a few areas of hills, but as we said, it was wet, it was moist, it was boggy. How good do you think a 20-ton tracked vehicle is going to do going through this sludge? Plus, imagine the impact of 3.5 million shells when the water table is just a few feet below the ground. All of the shells, all they did was basically bring the water to the surface. And they took out any type of water control measures that the Belgians had put in place. They blew up dikes and dams and irrigation dishes. Everything was shattered, which basically allowed the water to flow. So over the whole salient, it just basically became a mud bog. And what happens when you try sending men through mud? This. Look at this guy. He's literally up to his knees. Horses don't do much better. Tanks, forget about it. Pockmarks, water, crater. That's what happens to any type of position you have. It's just nothing but mud. And what happens when you're in the mud? Well, I don't know if you can tell right here, but that's a poor guy. He's quite dead. Because when you get stuck in the mud, it's easy for someone with a decent ability with a rifle to go, and you end up dead. But he tried. He tried. July 31st. That's when the big drive happened. Like I told you, he believed he'd be able to break through. He believed he would be able to outflank the German lines, that he would be able to penetrate to Belgium and basically begin a race to the German border. But Flanders, it's a cruel, cruel mistress. She does not give. She only takes. And the end result is death on a scale so bad that even the Germans would be willing to help Allied soldiers that are stuck in the mud. That's how bad it was. This was a war of attrition that resulted in virtually no change in the frontier. While they were able to advance about 6 miles, by the end of the battle, they had actually fallen back 4.5 miles. The line started here. They managed to push out to here, this was the starting point. They got this far, only to be driven this far back. They actually lost ground. And what did it cost them? 245,000 casualties. Now, here is a simple truism. To win a war, you have to kill more of the enemy. He suffered 245,000 casualties, dead, injured men. Germany only suffered 200,000. Not only did this brilliant plan lose ground, he also lost more men. In a war of attrition, you don't win. You don't win. Questions? Oh, I want to be able to cover this, but I don't have enough time to finish it. So I'm not going to. We'll stop early today. Come back. We'll do Cambrai, which is basically the last military operation in 1917, and then we'll start with 1918. Papers, papers, papers. Don't forget your papers. 20%. 20% final grade.